Chapter 11. In obedience to the voice on the telephone and following the orders he had been given, Lance Corporal Nikolai Turbin led his group of 28 cadets out onto the streets and right across the city. These orders brought Nikolka and his cadets to a completely empty crossroads. Although the crossroads seemed totally lifeless, there was a lot of gunfire. All around them, in the sky, on the roofs and walls, the crackle of machine gun fire could be heard. These crossroads were clearly where the enemy should have been, for they had been the final destination in the telephone message. But for the moment, there was no enemy in sight, and Nikolka was a little uncertain what he should do now. His cadets, like their commander, looking a little pale but not lacking in courage, spread out in a line on the snow-covered street, all except for the machine gunner, Ivashin, who squatted by his weapon on the side of the street. Raising their heads from the ground, the cadets looked warily ahead of them, waiting to see what exactly was about to happen. Their leader, meanwhile, was so engrossed in thought that he seemed to have shrunk and become even paler. He was struck, first of all, by the absence at the crossroads of everything that the voice on the telephone had promised. He was supposed to be reinforcing a group of men from the 3rd Detachment who should have been there, but they weren't, and there was no trace of them at all. Secondly, Nikolka was struck by the fact that the rattle of machine gun fire could be heard not only in front of them, but also to their left, and even, it seemed, behind them. Thirdly, he was afraid of being frightened, and constantly put himself to the test by asking, "Am I afraid?" "No, I am not afraid," his inner voice would reply buoyantly, and feeling proud that the fact of his bravery had been confirmed in this way, Nikolka turned even paler. This pride turned into the thought that, if he were to be killed, then he would be buried to music. It would all be very simple. He imagined a white, silk-lined coffin moving serenely down the street, carrying the body of Lance Corporal Turbin, killed in battle, with a noble expression on his wax-like face. It was a pity that crosses for bravery were no longer awarded, otherwise he would certainly be wearing a cross on his chest, as well as the ribbon of St. George. Peasant women would be standing at the gate and asking, "Who are they burying, my dear?" "Lance Corporal Turbin. Oh, what a handsome man." And then the music. It is good to die in battle, people say, just so long as you don't suffer. Thinking about the music and the medals helped somewhat to compensate for his uncertainty regarding the enemy, an enemy who evidently had not obeyed the voice on the telephone and who was not going to turn up at all. "We'll wait here," Nikolka said to the cadets, trying to make his voice sound as assured as possible, but without totally succeeding. There was something not quite right about the whole situation, and it had all become a little absurd. Where was the detachment? Where was the enemy? And it was strange that the shooting seemed to be coming from behind them. And so the leader waited with his troops. Suddenly, in a little side street that led from the crossroads to the Brest-Litovsk highway, shots rang out, and grey figures came pouring along the street in headlong flight. They were rushing straight for Nikolka's cadets, their rifles pointing in all directions. "Are we surrounded?" The thought flashed through Nikolka's mind, and he hesitated, not knowing what order to give. But the next moment, he was able to make out the gold patches on the shoulders of some of those running towards him, and he realized that they were on his side. The tall, strapping, fur-capped cadets from the Constantine Military Academy, covered in sweat from their exertions, flung themselves down on one knee and fired 2 rounds, their rifle muzzles flashing faintly as they aimed down the street from which they had just emerged. Then they leapt up, flung down their rifles, and dashed off across the crossroads and past Nikolka's men. As they ran, they tore off their epaulets, cartridge pouches, and belts, tossing them down onto the flattened snow. As one large, well-built, grey-coated cadet ran past Nikolka, he turned to his men and, gasping for breath, shouted out in a booming voice, "Run! Follow us! Save yourselves if you can!" Shocked at the sight of all this, the line of Nikolka's cadets began to stand up. Nikolka stood still for a moment, totally stupefied. Then, immediately, he took a grip on himself, one thought flashing through his brain like lightning. "This is my chance to become a hero." Then he gave a piercing shout. "Don't dare stand up!
Obey my orders!
What on earth are they doing? Nikolka said to himself, enraged. When they reached the other side of the crossroads, the 20 or so Constantine Academy cadets, now weaponless, dispersed down Fanani Alley, some of them dashing into the first enormous gateway. The metal gates closed with a thunderous crash, and their boots could be heard clattering up the stairwell. A second group ran into the next gateway. The five remaining men continued to run faster and faster down Fanani and disappeared into the distance. Then one more fleeing figure, the final one with faint gold epaulettes on his coat, appeared on the crossroads. With a single sharp-eyed glance, Nikolka instantly recognized the figure of the commander of the second squad of the first detachment, Colonel Nytours.
Colonel!
Called out Nikolka, confused and yet at the same time elated.
Your men are fleeing in panic!
At this point, something quite outrageous happened. Nytours ran out onto the trampled snow of the crossroads, his greatcoat tucked up on both sides in the manner of a French infantryman. His battered service cap, held in place by a chin strap, was perched on the back of his head. In his right hand, he held a Colt pistol, the open holster dangling and banging on his hip. He had not shaved for some time, and his bristly face bore a grim expression. His eyes were turned inwards, and when he came closer, the zigzag epaulettes of a hussar regiment were clearly visible on his shoulders. Nytours ran up to Nikolka, and with one sweep of his free left hand, tore off first Nikolka's left epaulette, and then the right. The waxed, good-quality threads holding the epaulettes in place snapped off with explosive force. In the case of the right-hand epaulette, taking a piece of Nikolka's greatcoat with them. The movement was so forceful that Nikolka instantly realized just how strong Nytours's hands were. Knocked backwards, Nikolka abruptly sat down on something soft, the something turning out to be the machine gunner, Ivashin, who leapt out from under him with a howl of protest. Then all hell broke loose as the dumbfounded faces of Nikolka's cadets danced around in front of his eyes. Nikolka was able to retain his sanity only because Nytours had acted so precipitately that he was too astonished to have time to do anything else. Turning to the scattered group of cadets, Nytours yelled out an order in his strange, inimitable accent. Nikolka had the irrational feeling that a voice like that could be heard for several miles, and probably throughout the city.
Cadets, listen to me. Tear off your epaulettes, cap badges, and cartilage pouches, and get lid of your weapons. Go down Fanani, then take the back way to Lajejaya Street, and then on to Podor. To Podor! Tear up your identity papers as you go, then scatter and hide, tearing anyone you meet to do the same.
Then, waving his pistol in the air, Nytours bawled out at the top of his voice with the force of a cavalry bugle,
Go down Fanani! Only Fanani, not any other way! Get to your homes and go into hiding! The fighting's over! Quickly!
For a few moments, the cadets were unable to collect their senses. Then they turned very pale. In front of Nikolka's eyes, Ivashin ripped off his epaulettes, flung his cartridge pouches onto the snow, and sent his rifle clattering along the raised verge of the pavement. Within 30 seconds, cartridge pouches and belts, together with someone's tattered service cap, lay abandoned on the crossroads. The cadets started running down Fanani, darting into one or other of the backyards that led out onto Rajejaya Street. Nytours returned his pistol to its holster with a flourish, ran to the machine gun by the pavement, crouched down beside it, and turned it round so that it faced the way he had come. With his left hand, he sorted out the cartridge belt. Then, from this position, he turned to Nikolka and yelled furiously,
Are you deaf or something? Go on! Run!
A strange, drunken feeling of ecstasy welled up from somewhere inside Nikolka, and his mouth turned instantly dry.
I don't wish to, Colonel,
he answered in a matter-of-fact voice, and squatting down on his haunches, grabbed the cartridge belt with both hands and started feeding it into the machine gun. Then, in the distance, farther down the street from which the remaining men of Nytours' detachment had emerged, several figures on horseback appeared. Nikolka and Nytours could dimly make out that the horses were prancing along skittishly and that the cavalrymen were holding the grey blades of swords in their hands. Nytours cocked the trigger and sent a burst of machine gun fire in their direction, then another, followed by a third, this time prolonged burst. Instantly, bullets started smashing into the roofs of houses on both sides of the street. Some more cavalrymen appeared, but then one of them darted off into a house. Another's horse reared up extraordinarily high, so that it almost reached the first floor, and several cavalrymen disappeared altogether. Then all the rest vanished as well, as if into the ground. Nitours released the trigger, shook his fist at the sky, and shouted, his eyes blazing,
"My poor boys! Those headquarters bastards!"
He turned to Nikolka and yelled in a voice that again sounded to Nikolka like a muted cavalry bugle,
"Clear off, you idiot! Clear off, I say!"
He looked back down the street again, making sure that all the cadets had disappeared. Then, looking along the crossroads to the distant street that ran parallel with the Brest-Litovsk highway, he shouted out in pain and in anger,
"Oh, damn it!"
Nikolka turned to look in the same direction, and saw far away on Cadet Street, by the unkempt snow-covered boulevard, dark lines of figures moving along, and then falling to the ground. Then, much closer on the corner of Fonani, right above his and Nitours' heads, a sign saying, "Berta Yakovlevna, Prince Metal, Dental Surgeon." The sign resounded with a clang, and somewhere on the other side of the gates, window panes shattered. Nikolka saw chunks of plaster leaping and bouncing along the pavement. He looked questioningly at Nitours, wondering what the distant figures and the plaster signified. But the colonel reacted strangely, grinning inappropriately, and leaping around on one leg while waving the other in the air, as if dancing a waltz. Then, suddenly, he was lying on the ground at Nikolka's feet. A black fog enveloped Nikolka's mind. Sobbing dryly without any tears, he bent down and tried to lift Nitours up by his shoulders. Only then did he see the blood trickling through the colonel's left sleeve and his eyes staring at the sky.
"Colonel, sir, colonel."
"Corporal,"
Nitours started to say, but then blood poured out of his mouth onto his chin, and his voice began to fade, weakening with every word.
"Stop being so damned heroic. I'm dying. Maroplovarnaya Street."
He didn't want to explain any further. His lower jaw began to shudder, twitching convulsively three times, as if he was suffocating, then stopped, and the colonel became as heavy as a bag of flour.
"So that's how people die, is it?" Nikolka thought. "It can't be. He was alive a moment ago. It seems it's not so terrible to die in battle. I wonder why I haven't been hit."
Dent, Urgen. The sign overhead quivered and shook for a second time, and once again there was the sound of glass shattering. Then the idiotic thought passed through Nikolka's confused brain that perhaps the colonel had simply fainted. He tried to pull him up, but to no avail.
"Am I afraid?"
he asked himself again, and he knew he felt hideously afraid.
"But why? Why?" he wondered.
But then he immediately realized that he was afraid, because he was desperately sad and totally alone. If only Colonel Nitours would get back up on his feet, then he wouldn't be afraid at all. But the colonel continued to lie there in front of him, completely motionless, unable to issue any commands, or to be aware of the large red puddle spreading by his sleeve, or of the plaster that was insanely breaking off and crumbling away on the wall ledges. No, Nikolka was afraid, because he was totally alone. There weren't any cavalry galloping by at that moment, but it was clear that everybody was against him, and that he was totally on his own, the last one left. And it was loneliness that drove Nikolka from the crossroads. He crawled along on his stomach, propelling himself by his hands and arms, in the case of his right arm, by his elbow, as he was clutching Nitours' Colt pistol in his palm. The fear hit him most strongly when he was a couple of yards from the corner of the street.
"Any minute now, and I'll be hit in the leg. Then I'll be unable to move, and Petliura's men will come riding up and hack me to pieces with their swords. Terrible to be lying on the ground with people hacking at you. If there are any bullets in Nitours' pistol, I'll fire at them. Just a bit farther. One more push with the arms."
And Nikolka found himself round the corner in Fonani Alley.
"How astonishing. Extraordinarily astonishing I haven't been hit. It's nothing but a miracle. It's the Lord God working miracles, Nikolka thought as he stood up. That's what a miracle is, then. I've experienced one for myself. Notre Dame Cathedral. Victor Hugo. I wonder if anything's happened to Yelena. And what about Alexei? Clearly, once you have your epaulets ripped off, that spells disaster. Nikolka leapt to his feet, up to his neck in snow. He put the colt in his greatcoat pocket and dashed down the street until he met the first gaping gateway to the right. He ran into the echoing archway and out onto a gloomy, squalid little yard with some red brick sheds on the right-hand side and a stack of logs on the left. Realizing that the way out was through the middle, he made a dash for it, slipping and sliding, and collided with someone in a sheepskin jacket. He could see him with total clarity. Ginger beard and tiny little eyes, leaking hatred. A snub-nosed Nero in a sheepskin cap. As if taking part in some light-hearted game, the man seized hold of Nikolka with his left arm while grabbing Nikolka's left hand with his other and twisting it behind his back. For several moments, Nikolka was too shocked to move. My God, he's got me. He hates me. One of Petliura's.
Got you, you little rat,
screeched the ginger-bearded man, pausing to gasp for breath.
Where do you think you're going? Stop, he yelled. Stop the cadets! Hold them, hold them! So you think you can take off your epaulette so that people won't know who you are, do you, you little rat? Hold them!
Filled from head to toe with an overwhelming sense of rage, Nikolka jerked his body down so abruptly that the belt on the back of his greatcoat snapped. Then he turned and with unnatural force freed himself from the clutches of the ginger-bearded man. Not seeing him for a moment, he turned, and there he was again. He had no weapon. Wasn't even a soldier, just the local caretaker. The rage that had been enveloping Nikolka's brain like a red blanket suddenly disappeared, to be replaced by an extraordinary sense of total control. He grinned like a young wolf, the wind and frost gushing into his hot body. He whipped the pistol from his pocket, thinking, "Let's hope there are some bullets, then I can kill the bastard." Then, when he did speak, his own voice seemed so strange and alien that he didn't recognize it.
"I'll kill you, you little snake!"
he shouted hoarsely, fingering the complex little colt, and then instantly realized he had forgotten how to fire it. Seeing that Nikolka was armed, the ginger-bearded caretaker fell to his knees in horrified despair, miraculously transforming himself somehow from a Nero into a snake.
"Your Honor, you're..."
he wailed. All the same, Nikolka would definitely have fired, had he been able to, but the colt remained silent. "Damn it, no bullets," he thought, his mind whirling. Shielding himself with his hand, the caretaker edged backwards and moved from a kneeling to a squatting position. Then he let out such a wail of anguish that it destroyed Nikolka. Unsure what he could do to close that huge, gaping mouth framed in its copper-colored beard, and in despair because his pistol had been unable to fire, Nikolka leapt onto the caretaker like a fighting cock and smashed the butt into the man's teeth, risking shooting himself as he did so. In a flash, Nikolka's rage dissipated. The caretaker jumped up and ran off back into the archway through which Nikolka had come. No longer wailing and out of his mind with terror, the caretaker ran off, slipping and stumbling on the ice. He turned once to look back, and Nikolka could see that half of his beard was covered in blood. Then he disappeared. Nikolka dashed off in the opposite direction, past the little brick shed, and towards the gate leading out onto Razyazhaya Street. There he stopped, overcome by despair.
"That's it. I'm finished. I'm too late and I'm trapped. And my God, the gun doesn't fire."
He shook at the huge bolt and lock, but to no avail. He had to do something. The ginger-headed caretaker had locked the gate as soon as Naitur's cadets had run through onto the street, leaving Nikolka confronting a completely insuperable obstacle in the form of a sheer metal barrier, totally without any footholds. He turned and glanced up at the sky, covered by extraordinarily dense and low-lying clouds, and saw a flimsy black ladder propped on a firewall leading up to the roof of a four-story building.
"Perhaps I could climb up that," he thought,
and immediately the graphic image of Nat Pinkerton, wearing a yellow jacket with a red mask over his face, clambering up just such a ladder, flashed absurdly through his mind. Nat Pinkerton? America, eh? All right, I'll climb up it, and then what? I'll be sitting on the roof like some idiot, and in the meantime the caretaker will have got hold of a group of Petliura's men. That Nero's sure to give me away. He won't forgive me for smashing his teeth in. And sure enough, he could hear the caretaker desperately shouting for help by the gate into Fornani Alley, and then the clatter of horses' hooves. Nikolka realized what must have happened. Petliura's cavalry had entered the city in a flanking movement and had already reached Fornani. So that's what Nitours had been shouting about. But there was no going back down Fornani now. These thoughts came to him as he stood unaccountably on the stack of logs piled next to the brickshed, under the wall belonging to the adjacent house. Ripping his trousers and stumbling and falling on the icy logs shifting around under his feet, he made his way to the wall. He looked over the top into an identical yard to the one he was in. The two courtyards were so alike that he expected the ginger Nero in the sheepskin coat to leap out onto him again, but nobody leapt out. With a terrible hollow feeling in his stomach and his side, he sat down on the ground. As he did so, his pistol jerked in his hand, and a deafening shot rang out. At first, he was astonished, but then he realized that the safety catch had been on all this time, and that his sudden movement had released it. That's a bit of luck, he thought. But the gate into Razhyazhaya Street here was just like the other one, dammit, locked and impossible to climb. Right then, let's try the next wall. But to his horror, he saw there were no logs by this one. Securing the safety catch, he put the pistol into his pocket. He clambered along a pile of broken bricks, and then started climbing up the sheer face of the wall like a fly, placing his feet into such tiny little nooks and crannies that normally wouldn't have accommodated even a small coin. With torn fingernails and his fingers covered in blood, he clawed his way to the top of the wall. As he lay there on his stomach, he heard, behind him in the first yard, a piercing whistle and Nero's voice. And then in front of him in the third yard, he saw a woman's face, distorted with horror, looking at him from a darkened first-floor window. Just for an instant. And then the face was gone. Tumbling off the wall, he landed, as luck would have it, in a fortunately placed snowdrift. But he twisted his neck and felt a sharp pain at the top of his skull. His head ringing and with flashes in his eyes, he ran to the gate. Absolute joy. This gate was locked as well, but that didn't matter. There was an elaborate metal railing on one side. Like a fireman, Nikolka clambered up it and down onto the other side, finding himself in Razhyazhaya Street. He saw that it was completely empty, not a soul about. Just a few moments' rest, to catch my breath, otherwise my heart will burst, he thought, gulping air into his overheated body. Ah, yes, my papers. He pulled a wad of dirty, oil-streaked papers out of his jacket pocket and tore them into pieces, scattering them all over the place like snowflakes. Behind him, from the direction of the crossroads where he had left Nitours, a machine gun opened up, to be answered by machine gun and rifle fire coming from in front of him, from the city. So that was it. There was fighting in the city center, and the city had been taken. Absolute disaster. Still breathing deeply, Nikolka brushed the snow off his body with both hands. What about the pistol? Should he throw that away, too? Nitours's pistol? No, not for one moment. He might be able to get through unscathed. They couldn't be everywhere at once, surely. Panting heavily and feeling his legs weakening and giving way under him, Nikolka ran along the empty Razhyazhaya Street and made his way without incident as far as the crossroads at the junction of two streets, Lubochitskaya leading to Podol and Lovskaya curving away towards the city center. By the side of a pillar, he saw a pool of blood and a pile of manure, together with two abandoned rifles and a blue student's cap. He hastily took off his fur cap, replacing it with the cap. It seemed rather too small for him, giving him an insolent, devil-may-care, non-military look, like some down-at-heel character who had been slung out of high school. Peering round the corner, he took an anxious glance down Lovskaya Street and saw a distant group of cavalry trotting along with dark blue patches on their fur caps. He could hear the crackle of rifle fire. There was clearly some trouble down there. So he darted down Lubochitskaya Street, where he saw his first live human being in the form of a woman running along the opposite pavement, a black feathered hat perched on one side of her head, and a grey bag swinging in her hand, from which a cockerel was desperately trying to claw its way out, and screeching with such force that the whole street could hear.
"Petura! Petura!"
it seemed to be shouting. Carrots were spilling out onto the pavement through a hole in the paper bag the woman was carrying. She was shouting and weeping as she ran, keeping close to the wall. Some well-to-do man whirled past, crossing himself furiously, and shouting,
"Oh, Christ, Jesus! Volodka! Volodka! Petliura's coming!"
At the end of Lubochitskaya Street, there were many people bustling and scurrying about, making quickly for the gates. Someone in a black coat, crazed with fear, dashed up to the gates, inserted his stick into the metal bars, and snapped it in half. Meanwhile, all this time, twilight had been coming on so fast that by now it had already arrived. When Nikolka turned off Lubochitskaya Street onto Volsky Hill, the electric street lamp on the corner lit up and began to hiss faintly. The shutters of a little shop crashed shut, instantly hiding a pile of multicolored boxes marked soap powder. A cabbie took a bend too sharply and crashed into a snowdrift, overturning his sleigh, and started lashing out at his miserable horse with his whip. Nikolka dashed past a four-story house with three entrances, all three of which were again and again being flung open. Someone in a sealskin fur collar rushed past Nikolka, yelling at the gate,
"Pyotr! Pyotr! Are you out of your mind? Close the gate! Close the gate!"
A door slammed shut in one of the entrances, and a woman's voice yelled from the dark staircase inside,
"Petliura's coming! Petliura!"
The closer Nikolka came to Podol, the safe area that Nytours had told him about, the greater the number of people who were dashing and bustling along the streets. But there seemed to be less fear, and not everyone was heading in the same direction as he was. Some were moving towards him. At the very top of the slope leading down to Podol, a young cadet in a grey greatcoat with white epaulettes emblazoned with the gold letter V emerged solemnly from the entrance to a grey stone building. He had a button nose, and his eyes darted animatedly from side to side. A large rifle was slung over one shoulder. When the people who were scurrying by caught sight of this armed young man, they scattered in all directions. But the cadet simply stood on the pavement and listened intently to the shooting coming from the upper city with a knowing, inquisitive expression on his face. His nose twitched, and he began to move off. Nikolka abruptly blocked his way, standing in the middle of the pavement and pressing right up against him.
"Get rid of that rifle and hide immediately," he whispered.
Alarmed, the cadet shuddered and took a step back, but then he clutched at his rifle threateningly. In a move born of experience, Nikolka pushed and forced the cadet back into the entrance between two doorways.
"Hide, I tell you," he repeated forcefully. "I'm a cadet. The situation's disastrous. Petliura's taken the city."
"What do you mean? How's he taken the city?" the cadet asked, his mouth open, revealing a tooth missing in his left jaw.
"That's how," answered Nikolka, pointing in the direction of the upper city. "Do you hear that? That's Petliura's cavalry moving along the streets. I've only just managed to escape myself. Run home, hide your rifle, and warn everyone you see."
The cadet froze to the spot in the entrance, speechless. That was how Nikolka left him. He had no time to waste with people who were so slow on the uptake. In Podol, the sense of alarm was less, but there were still plenty of people on the move. Passers-by quickened their step, flinging back their heads to listen, while cooks hurried into entrances and gateways, wrapping themselves in grey shawls. The crackle of machine-gun fire from the upper city was now constant. But at this twilight hour on the 14th of December, nowhere, neither in the distance nor close by, was there the sound of heavy artillery. Nikolka still had a long way to go. By the time he had crossed Podol, the streets had already become shrouded in twilight. The heavily falling snow, its flakes glistening in the lamplight, blanketed the sound of anxious people scurrying along. Here and there through the snow he glimpsed cheerful lights in shop windows, but not everywhere. Some windows had already gone completely dark. The snow was beginning to settle more and more. When Nikolka finally arrived at the bottom of the steep slope of his street, St. Alexei's Hill, and started to walk up it, he came across the following scene by the gateway to number 7. Two boys in grey knitted jackets and headgear had just tobogganed down from the top of the hill. One of them, as small and round as a ball and plastered with snow from head to foot, was sitting on the ground, roaring with laughter. The other one, slightly older, a thin, serious-looking lad, was untying the knot on his rope. Another lad in a sheepskin coat was standing by the gate, picking his nose. The sound of gunfire intensified, flaring up in various different places above them.
"Hey, Vaska, I really banged my bum back there against a post,"
the younger boy shouted. "Look at them tobogganing like that, without a care in the world," thought Nikolka in astonishment, and turned to the lad in the sheepskin coat. "Can you please tell me," he asked softly, "what that shooting is up there?" The lad took his finger out of his nose and said nasally,
"That's our boys giving the officers what for."
Nikolka looked at him mistrustfully, absent-mindedly fingering the pistol in his pocket.
"They're getting their own back on the officers,"
the older boy put in angrily.
"Serves them right. There's only 800 of them in the entire city, and they've behaved like idiots. Petliura's here now, and he's got a million men."
He turned and started pulling the toboggan back up the hill. The cream-coloured curtain between the veranda and the small dining room was flung open immediately. The clock ticked on. Tonk, tank.
"Is Alexei back?"
Nikolka asked Yelena.
"No,"
she replied, and burst into tears. It was dark. The entire apartment was dark, except for a lamp shining in the kitchen where Anyuta was sitting weeping, her elbows propped on the table. She was weeping naturally for Alexei Vasilievich. In Yelena's bedroom, the logs glowed in the fire, spitting out embers through the damper, emitting hot sparks that danced around for a moment on the floor. Having cried her heart out for Alexei, Yelena sat on a little stool, her cheek propped on her fist. Bathed in the red glow of the fire, Nikolka lay on the floor at her feet, his legs spread out like a pair of scissors. This colonel, this Bolbotun, the Shcheglovs had been putting it about that afternoon that he was none other than Grand Duke Mikhail Alexandrovich. Here, in the semi-darkness, in the glow of the fire, there was a general sense of despair. But what was the point of weeping for Alexei? Tears, of course, wouldn't help at all. He had been killed. There was no doubt about it. It was obvious. Nobody was taking any prisoners. The fact that he hadn't come home meant that he had been killed, together with the rest of the battalion. The worst thing of all, so they said, was that Petliura had over 800,000 men, all hand-picked elite troops. We had been betrayed and sent to our deaths. But where had this terrifying army come from? It had appeared seemingly from nowhere, fashioned from the needle-sharp, blue, twilight air, from the frost and the mist. Mist. Everywhere mist. Yelena stood up and stretched out her hand.
"It's those Germans, damn them to hell. If God doesn't punish them, then he has no sense of justice. Surely they won't get away with what they've done, will they? No, they'll answer for it. They will suffer, just as we are suffering now. I know they will."
She repeated the words "they will" several times persistently, as if uttering a curse. The red light from the fire played on her face and neck, and her vacant eyes were dark with hatred. Yelena's outburst had reduced Nikolka, lying on the floor with his legs spread out, to a state of absolute gloom and despair.
"Maybe he's still alive," he said hesitantly. "After all, he is a doctor, isn't he? Maybe he's not dead, but in captivity somewhere."
"They'll be eating cats and killing each other just like us,"
Yelena shouted, gesturing savagely at the fire.
"Oh my goodness," thought Nikolka. "Bolbotun simply can't be a grand duke. 800,000 men? That's just impossible, let alone a million. It's all nothing but mist and fog. We've been hit by really hard times now, and that clever so-and-so Thalberg clearly got away from it all just in time. Look at the fire dancing on the floor. Surely there have been peaceful times and beautiful countries, haven't there? Paris, for example, or Louis with those little images on his hat, or Hugo's Clopin Trouillefou, crawling around the floor and warming himself
in front of a fire just like this. And he was happy, even though he was a beggar. Nowhere has there ever been such a vile little snake as that ginger-headed caretaker Nero. All right, everybody hates us, I know, but he was just an unmitigated swine, twisted my arm behind my back. Then suddenly, there was the sound of heavy gunfire. Nikolka leapt up and started pacing up and down.
Do you hear that? Do you hear that, do you? Perhaps it's the Germans. Perhaps it's the Allies who've come to our aid. Who is it? Surely they can't be firing at the city if they've already taken it, can they?
Yelena folded her arms on her chest and said,
Nikol, there's no way I'm going to allow you to go out there. No way. I implore you not to go anywhere. Don't even think about it. It would be madness.
I'd only want to go as far as the square by St. Andrew's Church, just to see what's happening, and to listen. You can see all of Podol from there.
All right, then go. Go if you want to leave me alone at such a time.
Nikolka stood there, embarrassed.
All right, then. I'll just go outside and listen in the backyard. And I'll come with you.
But, Lenochka, what if Alexei should come back? You won't be able to hear the front doorbell.
No, that's right, we won't, and it will be your fault.
All right then, Lenochka, I give you my word that I'll keep to the yard, not a step beyond.
Promise?
I promise.
You won't go out of the gate, or up the hill. You'll stay in the yard.
Word of honour.
Well, off you go then.
On the 14th of December 1918, the city was covered in a blanket of thick snow. And this strange, totally unexpected gunfire started up at 9 o'clock in the evening, lasting for no more than a quarter of an hour. The snow had melted under Nikolka's collar, and he struggled against the temptation to climb up to the snow-covered hills above him. From up there, it would have been possible to see not only Podol, but also part of the upper city, the seminary, the tall buildings with their hundreds of rows of lights, and the little houses on the hills with their icon lamps burning in the windows. But no one must break their word once they have given it. Otherwise, it is not possible to live on this earth. That was what Nikolka thought. At every threatening boom of distant gunfire, he would pray,
Oh, Lord, please let it...
But then the guns fell silent.
Those were our guns, he said sorrowfully to himself.
As he walked back from the gate, he glanced in at the Shiglov's window next door. The little white curtain in the annex window had been pulled back, and he could see Maria Petrovna washing little Pietka. The naked Pietka was sitting in a tub, weeping soundlessly, because some soap had got into his eyes. Maria Petrovna wrung out the sponge over Pietka. There was some washing hanging on a line, and Maria Petrovna's large shadow moved back and forth by the line, bending under it from time to time. As Nikolka stood there shivering in his unbuttoned greatcoat, everything in the Shiglov household seemed very warm and cozy. In the deep snow some 5 miles to the north of the city outskirts, a staff captain was sitting in a small abandoned watchman's hut that was totally buried in the white snow. On a little table there were some hunks of bread, a field telephone, and a tiny 3-wick lamp with a bulbous, blackened glass cover. A fire was burning in a little stove. The captain, a small man with a long, pointed nose, wore a greatcoat with a large collar. He was tearing to pieces and crumbling a hunk of bread with his left hand, while pressing the buttons on the telephone with his other. But there was no answer. The telephone seemed to have gone dead. For a couple of miles round the captain, there was nothing except pitch darkness and driving snow. The snow had formed into huge drifts. After another hour of this, the captain left the telephone in peace. Around 9 o'clock in the evening, he started snuffling.
I'm going out of my mind, he suddenly said out loud. There's nothing for it but to shoot myself.
At that moment, as if in reply, the telephone rang.
Is that battery number 6?
Asked a distant voice.
Yes, yes,
the captain answered, deliriously happy. The distant, agitated voice seemed jubilant, even if a little muffled.
Open fire immediately on the wooded area, squawked
the blurred voice at the other end of the line.
Everything you've got.
The voice broke off.
I have the feeling that...
At that point, the line went dead again.
Yes, I hear you. I hear you!
The captain shouted into the receiver, baring his teeth in despair. There was a long pause.
But I can't open fire,
he said into the receiver. He had to speak, even though he was perfectly aware that he was talking into a total void.
All my men and my three ensigns have run off. I'm the only one left. Inform post.
The captain sat there for another hour, and then went outside. It was snowing and blowing hard. The four sullen and fearsome-looking guns were already covered in snow, with ridges forming on the muzzles and breech blocks. The captain jabbed around like a blind man in the cold, whirling snow and the wail of the blizzard. In the darkness and the snow, he stuck at the task for a long time, until he was finally able, through touch alone, to remove the first breech block. At first he wanted to toss it down the well behind the watchman's hut, but then he thought better of it and went back into the hut. He came out again three more times to remove the remaining breech blocks, hiding them together with the potatoes in the little space under the floorboards. Then he extinguished the lamp and went out into the darkness. He walked for 2 hours, his feet sinking in the snow, totally invisible in the dark, until he reached the main road leading to the city. The dim light of an occasional street lamp could be seen. Under the first of these lamps, a group of cavalrymen with tasseled caps killed him with their swords, taking his boots and watch. In a dugout 3 miles or so away to the west of the watchman's hut, the same voice sprang to life on the end of the line.
Open fire on the wooded area immediately. It seems that the enemy has slipped between us and into the city.
Can you hear me? Are you there?
Answered the dugout.
Find out from post.
Sudden silence. Without listening to the reply, the voice continued squawking.
Rapid fire on the wooded area, on the cavalry!
Then the line went totally dead. 3 officers with torches and 3 cadets in sheepskin coats clambered out of the dugout. A 4th officer and 2 more cadets were standing by a gun under a lamp that the blizzard was threatening to extinguish. 5 minutes later, and the guns started to leap around as they fired into the darkness. The crash and roar of the guns could be heard throughout the whole area, over a radius of 12 miles, reaching as far as number 13 on St. Alexei's Hill. O Lord, please let it. Whirling through the blizzard, a cavalry squadron leapt out of the dark from behind the lamps and cut down all the cadets and the 4 officers. The battery commander, who had remained in the dugout by the telephone, shot himself through the mouth, his last words being,
Those headquarters bastards! I can understand the Bolsheviks perfectly.
That night, Nikolka switched on the ceiling light in his little corner room and carved out a large cross on his door using a penknife to scratch the following unsteady inscription. Colonel Tours, 14th December 1918, 4 p.m. He omitted the nigh, just in case Petliura's men should come searching the house. He didn't want to sleep, afraid he might miss the front doorbell. He knocked on Yelena's wall and said,
Go ahead and sleep. I'll stay awake.
And immediately he fell into a deep sleep, lying fully dressed on the bed. But Yelena, on the other hand, stayed awake all night, waiting and waiting for the bell to ring. But it didn't ring. Of their elder brother Alexei, there was no sign. A tired, shattered person needs to sleep. It was already 11 o'clock, but Nikolka slept on and on in somewhat strange circumstances, I have to report. His boots were too tight, his belt was digging into his ribs, his collar was choking him, and a nightmare was sinking its claws into his chest. Nikolka had collapsed flat on his back onto the bed. His face had turned purple, and he was whistling as he breathed in and out. A whistle. Snow all around, and some cobweb or other. The cobweb was everywhere, damn it. More than anything, he needed to break his way out of the cobweb, otherwise the blasted thing would get bigger and bigger until it reached his face. And it might well wrap itself around him so tightly that he wouldn't be able to get out at all, and then he'd suffocate. Through the strands of the web he could see nothing but the purest snow, as much snow as you could imagine, acres and acres of it. He had to make his way out to this snow as quickly as possible. Someone seemed to be saying, Nikol, in an anguished voice. And then, just imagine, a cheery little bird seemed to get caught in the web as well and started chirping. Ticky, ticky, wee-oo, wee-oo, ticky, ticky. Damn it. He couldn't see the bird itself, but it was chirping and tweeting somewhere very close to him. And then there was the sound of someone weeping and moaning, and once again the voice shouting, Nick, Nick, Nikolka! Ugh, Nikolka croaked as he ripped the cobweb away and sat bolt upright, bedraggled and disheveled, his belt buckle twisted to one side. His blonde hair stood on end as if someone had been ruffling it for a long time.
Who is it? Who is it?
Nikolka asked in a terrified voice, not understanding a thing.
Who? 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 Yes? Yes? Fee-tee? Fee-oo? Fee-oo?
The cobweb replied, and a mournful voice, trying hard to hold back the tears, said,
Yes, with her lover.
Terrified, Nikolka pressed up against the wall and stared at the apparition. It was wearing a brown army jacket, brown riding breeches and yellow-topped jockey's boots. Its clouded, mournful eyes looked out at the world from the deepest of sockets, framed by an improbably large, close-shaven head. It was clearly young, this apparition, but the skin on its face was grey, like an old man's, and its teeth were crooked and yellow. It was carrying a large cage covered by a black shawl and an unsealed blue letter.
I must still be asleep, Nikolka reasoned to himself, and gestured with his hand, trying to dispel the apparition as he had with the cobweb.
But his fingers became jammed extremely painfully in the bars of the cage. The bird in the cage immediately went berserk, screeching and shouting in fury.
Nikolka?
Came Yelena's anxious voice from a long distance away.
Oh, Lord Jesus Christ, thought Nikolka. No, I am awake after all, but have simply gone out of my mind. And I know why. I'm exhausted from all the fighting. My God, I'm already beginning to see things, and look at my fingers. My God. Alexei's not returned. Yes, that's it. He's not returned. He's been killed. Oh, no, please, no.
With her lover on the very same sofa,
the apparition said in a tragic voice,
on which I used to read poetry to her.
The apparition turned towards the door, evidently addressing someone listening outside, but then it turned eagerly back towards Nikolka.
Yes, on the very same sofa. They're sitting there now, embracing and kissing each other, after I signed promissory notes to the value of 75,000. Signed like a gentleman without a moment's hesitation, for I always have been and always will be a gentleman. Let them kiss each other.
Oh, no, thought Nikolka, his eyes rolling and a chill running up his spine.
But you must forgive me, said the apparition,
emerging gradually from the shadowy substance of dream and assuming more and more the form of a real live person.
You probably don't fully understand what this is all about, so please take a look at this letter. It will explain everything. As a gentleman, I will not hide my disgrace from anybody.
At this, the stranger handed Nikolka a blue letter. In total shock, Nikolka took the letter and began to read it, his lips moving. Undated, it was written on soft blue notepaper in large, sprawling and agitated handwriting. My darling, darling Lenochka, knowing what a kind-hearted person you are, I am sending him directly to you as one of the family. I have sent you a telegram, but he'll be able to tell you all about it himself, poor boy. Lariosik has had a most terrible shock, and for a long time I was afraid he wouldn't get over it. You remember he married Milochka Rubtsova a year ago? Well, she turned out to be a real snake in the grass. I implore you to take care of him and look after him as only you know how. I will send you a regular allowance for his upkeep. He has come to loathe Zhytomyr, and I totally understand why. I won't be writing again. I'm too upset, and the hospital train will be here very shortly. He'll be able to tell you everything. Fondest love and kisses to you and to Seryozha. The signature at the bottom was indecipherable.
I brought the bird with me, said the stranger with a sigh. A bird is a man's best friend. Many people, it is true, wonder what's the point of having a bird in the house, but I'll only say that at least it doesn't do anybody any harm.
Nikolka liked this last idea very much. Content not to try to understand anything for the moment, he gently brushed his eyebrows with the mysterious letter and began to get up from the bed, wondering whether it would be rude to ask the stranger his surname. What an extraordinary turn of events, he thought.
Is it a canary?
He asked.
Yes, but what a canary, the stranger exclaimed proudly. Actually, it's not just any old canary. It's a genuine male canary. I've got 15 of them back in Zhytomyr. I took them over to Mama. She'll be able to feed them. That scoundrel would probably have broken their necks. He hates birds. Can I put it on your desk for now?
Go ahead, Nikolka answered. So, you're from Zhytomyr, are you?
Yes, answered the stranger. And just imagine, what a coincidence. I arrived at the same time as your brother.
What brother?
What do you mean, what brother? Your brother arrived at the same time as I did, the stranger said, astonished at the question.
What brother? Nikolka shouted plaintively. What brother? From Zhytomyr?
Your older brother.
Nikolka! Nikolka! Yelena's voice could be heard clearly, calling from the sitting room. Ilarion Larionich, could you wake him up, please? Tricky, tricky, tweet, tweet, chirped the bird at the top of its voice. Nikolka dropped the blue letter and flew like a bullet through the library into the dining room. There he froze to the spot, his arms stretched out wide. On the sofa, under the clock, lay the motionless figure of Alexei Turbin, wearing someone else's black coat with a torn lining and trousers. His face had a bluish pallor, and his teeth were tightly clenched. Yelena bustled about nearby. Her dressing gown had fallen open, revealing her black stockings and lace underwear. She was clutching now at the buttons on Alexei's chest and now at his hands. Nikol! Nikol! She shouted. 3 minutes later, and Nikolka, his student's cap on the back of his head and his grey army coat unbuttoned, was running up St. Alexei's Hill, panting heavily. What if he's not there? He muttered to himself. What extraordinary goings-on with that strange man in his yellow boots. Mustn't ask Kuritsky under any circumstances. Kit and cat. The canary song rattled around in his head deafeningly. Kitty, kitty, cot. An hour later, a bowl full of reddish water stood on the dining room floor, together with pieces of red-stained cotton wool and fragments of the white dish which the stranger in the yellow-topped boots had swept off the sideboard as he was reaching for a glass. The fragments of the dish crunched underfoot as people ran and walked over them. Alexei, his face still pale but no longer bluish, lay flat on his back on the pillow. He had regained consciousness and was trying to say something, but the doctor, a man with a pointed beard and rolled-up sleeves and wearing a pair of gold pince-nez, leant down over him and, wiping his blood-stained hands with pieces of gauze, said,
"Don't try to speak, doctor."
Together, the two of them, Anyuta wide-eyed and her face as white as chalk, and Yelena, her golden hair dishevelled, lifted Alexei up and took off his wet, blood-stained shirt with its sleeve cut open.
"You might as well cut off some more," the bearded doctor said. "It's no use to him now, anyway."
With scissors, they cut Alexei's shirt into small shreds, revealing his thin, yellowish body and his left arm, which had been bandaged right up to the shoulder. The ends of splints poked out from above and below the bandage. Nikolka knelt down, carefully unbuttoned Alexei's trousers, and took them off.
"Undress him completely and get him straight into bed," the bearded doctor said in his bass voice.
Anyuta began pouring water onto his arms and hands from a jug, and the soap flakes dripped down into the basin. The stranger stood a little way off to one side, taking no part in the hustle and bustle, looking mournfully now at the shattered crockery, and now, his face blushing, at the sight of the dishevelled Yelena, whose dressing gown had come completely undone. His eyes were moist with tears. They all carried Alexei from the dining room to his own room. Even the stranger did his bit by putting his arms under Alexei's knees and bearing the weight of his legs. In the sitting room, Yelena offered the doctor some money, but he withdrew his hand.
"What are you thinking of, for goodness sake?" he said. Do you think I'd take money from a doctor? More importantly, he should really go to the hospital.
No, I can't, came Alexei's feeble voice from the next room. I can't go to the hosp...
Be quiet, colleague, the doctor responded. We can manage without you. But I understand, of course. God knows what's going on in the city at the moment. He nodded towards the window. Maybe he's right. He can't go. Well, then, we'll have to manage at home. I'll come again this evening.
Is it serious, doctor?
Yelena asked anxiously. The doctor stared down at his feet, as if the diagnosis lay somewhere in the brilliant yellow of the parquet flooring. Then he grunted and stroked his beard. The bone's intact, he said. So are the major blood vessels. But the wound's bound to fester. Strands of wool from his coat got into the wound. And he has a fever. Having delivered these disjointed, arcane statements, the doctor raised his voice and said with greater assurance, Complete rest. Morphine if he's in pain. I'll give him some myself this evening. Only liquids to eat. Some bouillon soup. And make sure he doesn't talk too much.
Please, doctor, he would like you not to say anything to anyone.
The doctor glowered at Yelena, looking at her sideways, and growled, Yes, I understand. How did this happen to him? Did he slip? Yelena merely gave a little sigh and spread her hands. Right then, the doctor said abruptly, and sidled like a bear out into the hallway.